The first reading this morning is from the elders of the Hopi Nation, Oraibi, Arizona.
There is a river flowing now very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel they are being torn apart and will suffer greatly. No, the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river, keep our eyes open and our heads above the water. See who is there with you and celebrate. At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment that we do, our spiritual growth and journey come to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and your vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones we've been waiting for.
The second reading is from Reverend Dr. Sandeka of the Meadville Lombard Theological School. What moves us, a lonely soul in community. At the end of my formal remarks in the New England Church, I asked the members of the audience if they might be willing to simply get together in small groups over a meal and talk about their unmet needs for community in their church. One of the most respected elder statesmen of the church stood up and slowly walked to the front of the assembly, faced his fellow congregants, and said he was interested in joining such a group. He had wanted something like this for years, he said, because he was lonely. I do not have any friends, he finally confessed. Waves of shock rolled through the gathering. How could he be lonely? He was a revered and beloved member of the congregation, a pillar of the church. Many persons expressed incredulity. When the group quieted down, the man spoke again, saying, "Every man in this room who is my age knows what I am talking about. Our social upbringing has taught us not to talk about our feelings. We are not supposed to be emotionally vulnerable or close to anyone except our wives." Something happened to me as he spoke. I felt the man's vulnerability. I could feel his vulnerability because of his heart, because his heart spoke the hidden language of my own heart, loneliness. My own social upbringing had taught me not to talk about my feelings to anyone, and I had learned to be emotionally invulnerable and closed to everyone. But now, here in the midst of this gathered community, someone so much like myself had stepped forward and said, "I'm lonely." He did not step forward as an authority figure or as someone whose racial identity or class status was at issue. He stepped forward to talk about his unmet needs for intimacy. His story was my story. My story was his story. He had heard a call and he responded. All of us in the room were now in the presence of an open space, an opened heart, a change of heart. A call for healing that could be performed only by a religious community because human salvation is not a solo act. That ends the reading. That man was not me, but I am that man. wait. UUA President Peter Morales delivered a sermon at General Assembly in Minneapolis last month that gave me the introduction I was looking for this discussion. He said that a 1985 survey, published in the American Sociological Review, replicated in 2004 to determine the changes that had occurred in the interim. The results were so stunning they were reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post. The key question in the survey was, how many people do you know with whom you can confide personal information? Respondents could answer 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, or more. In 1985, for you statisticians, the modal answer, or the answer given most often, was 3. About a quarter of the people answered 3. In 2004, the answer given most often was 0. In 1985, the percentage of people responding 0 was 10%. In 2004, it was 25%. This was a stunning change. The number of people who answered 1 was almost as high, and it was usually a life partner. So, just under half of all Americans reported they had either no one or only one person with whom they could share intimate information. Now you can relax. I'm not going to ask you all where you fit into this continuum. But the topic of today's service is community. And what I'd like to do is explore with you as food for thought how we operate as a community. First, what is community? Merriam-Webster has, of course, several definitions. People with common interests living in a particular area, an interacting population of various kinds of individuals in a common location, perhaps most appropriate today given the prevalence of electronic communications, a collection or group of people who have something in common and interact. Are we a community? Do we interact? Do we know each other and the challenges we might be facing at this point in time or at any other? We might be surprised by the answers. So here are some questions for us all. I don't want to embarrass anyone, but would ask you to consider responding as truthfully as you feel comfortably doing, and please raise your hand for any of the following that apply to you, to us. Don't look around, just raise your hand. How many of you have lost your homes in the past year or two? I see a couple of tentative hands. How many of you are concerned that you may in the next year or two? How many of you have lost a job in the last year or two? Now, there are a few more. How many are looking for a job right now? Also a few more. How many of you have lost or may lose health care? So this isn't an isolated situation. How many of you didn't think that we'd have this sort of number of responses? And that leads me to Community in Challenging Times, or CICT, and the opportunity we have to build a community where we have something in common and interact. CICT is a group of 32 people within this congregation who have come forward to help our members, and now even beyond us to the wider community, with expert advice or support in all of the above areas and more. And we've been doing this for a year and a half. Yet, time and again, when I talk to the people who man our tables on Sunday, they report very few or no inquiries or requests for help. I have to ask myself, could this be related to the survey results I quoted earlier? I know from firsthand experience how a community of UUs responds when there is need. About 15 years ago, when we lived in Maryland, Donna, my wife, and I returned home at about midnight from a performance we'd given at our church. Our water heater had burst, and the whole basement was flooded. We were so exhausted, we just turned off the water and crashed. I was in despair and had no idea what we could do. Who could we call on? The next morning at Sunday service, I lit a candle of concern and announced the experience. We went home, and about a half hour later, members started showing up. They brought mops, industrial vacuums, buckets, work gloves, about 30 in total, cleaning out the basement, threw out all items destroyed, dried out, and set up fans to finish the job. That was community, and I'll never forget it. How about us here? What sort of challenges do some of us face? Some of us that perhaps you would never imagine might have difficulties. A few brave members and friends have offered to give first-person stories of some of their recent experiences, including the help they have received. I'll just ask Dorothy to pass the microphone around as we listen to their stories. Donna Carroll, over here.
Hi. I'm Donna.
It's on
now. Okay. I'm Donna Carroll. Let me get organized. I have a long and antagonistic relationship with insurance. I'm diabetic, and I'm in my seventh year of remission from hepatitis C, which I had for 24 years. A lack of insurance and a lack of ability to self-pay have prevented me from getting care for either of these conditions for almost 2 years. During this time, I've taken only half doses of my prescribed medicines. I had no idea I would get emotional. 2 months ago, I finally ran out of my medicine completely, and Alice sent me to the free clinic, and they renewed my prescriptions and advised me to go to a sliding scale neighborhood clinic to get primary care management. But as I tried to make an appointment to do this, I can never get through. And they asked me to leave my number and for a call back, and then I don't get the call back. And the demand on these clinics is okay. So I have returned now to taking half doses of my medicines and am concerned about what I'm going to do when I run out again. And interestingly enough, this is my situation, and I paid for insurance last year. I have student insurance through the seminary. It didn't cover pre-existing conditions, and then when it did cover pre-existing conditions, I learned it only covered catastrophic care. So basically, I discovered that I paid my premiums to ensure that the doctors and hospitals would get their money if I came in through the emergency room. In the meantime, I wonder when and how I'm going to get access to the blood work and the prescription medicine that I need to manage my diabetes. And frankly, I don't want insurance. I just want health care. Even though I currently live in a socioeconomic underclass, I deserve the same life preserver as a person living on the upper decks. I'm grateful for the support of this community. Dr. Alice Farina opened her house to me a year and a half ago when I lost my job. And she leads the Single Payer Action Network to make equal access to health care a reality for all people.
Thank you, Donna. Next is Doris Osler.
I wrote this down for you. I grew up in a family, probably not unlike most of yours, where my parents stressed the message, learn to take care of yourself, don't be dependent on anyone or on the government. To that end, there was strong encouragement to attend college. I come from an incredibly large family, and no one except two cousins completed college. Yet my family of four children brags three college graduates, so I think that part of the message got through. But now we find out that an education doesn't always guarantee a good job and financial security. Mom and Dad, if they were alive, would be flummoxed by the fact that most of my last 40 months have been spent as an unemployed person with no health insurance, with gutted retirement funds and high credit card debt, and with minimal prospects. Blame the economy? Perhaps. Blame the fact that I'm now an older worker? Perhaps that also. I have no way of knowing except in my gut. Blame me? Maybe I'm just lazy, but I don't think so. I've tried to get up every morning, shower, and don clean clothes just to help my focus. But many days I felt discouraged. I'd ponder all those bills and shed tears that my dear sister would help me pay some of those. Oh, I'll pay her back for sure, but now she's become one more bill. Interviews I had often were promising but didn't materialize into employment. I was told I had fine credentials and interviewed well. I graciously thanked them for their time and asked them to keep me in mind for future openings, but I still couldn't shake the fact that younger candidates were getting the jobs and I was being passed over. Many folks my age are indeed now retiring, so I can see how a future employer might think that if I were hired, I'd simply leave in a couple of years. So I come back to the question of dependency. I think my parents were wise to instill such a lesson in their children, but I also think we need to teach and to learn that to give and accept help is okay. It has proved to me to be a blessing to learn to hear about stories from other people and to accept kind words of encouragement, caring hugs, and certainly tips about possible job openings. I even humbly accepted $40 from a dear person in this congregation who was afraid I wouldn't eat. How can I say thank you except to say thank you? But it doesn't escape me that caring is reciprocal. It is my beloved joy to be supportive of you and my family and friends who, too, struggle with all manner of life challenges. In fact, I think it's one of life's highest callings to continually and consistently and lovingly be with each other, to truly be with each other. So tomorrow morning, I will get up and shower and put on clean clothes. Only these clothes will be business attire. I will drive up to my brand new job to begin what I hope will be a fruitful career. It took hard work. It took attitude. It took luck. It took pushing through the frustration. It took remembering my parents' teaching. But it certainly took the loving and supportive care of many of you in this very room to keep me plugging away.
Thank you, Doris. Now, Catherine Volstich.
My name is Catherine Falstick. I'm a barista at Starbucks. I developed a repetitive motion injury in my hands while working. Before I realized what it was, it had gotten so bad that I couldn't work. It kept me up at night with pain and worry. I was crying from the pain and dropping things because the nerves in my hands weren't working properly. I had to stop working for 3 months. During this time, I had to keep my hands in braces all the time, and I couldn't really do anything. It was very difficult. After seeing many doctors and lots of physical therapy, I got back to the point where I could work again. And the process to get help for the mountain of medical bills began at this time. My case manager from Starbucks told me I didn't need to go to the workers' compensation hearing, that they would take care of me. I found out when I went anyways. I found out when I went anyways that they were going to fight hard and I needed a lawyer. At the second hearing, with a lawyer to help me, my case was approved. I thought it was all going to be okay. Just before the third hearing, I got a call from my attorney telling me that my doctor now disavowed any knowledge of my injury and had misplaced all my records. Needless to say, the claim was lost at that point. After that, I received a letter from Starbucks Insurance Company saying that I could not claim for short-term disability because my injury had happened at work. This left me with no money as I had burned through all my savings on co-payments and trying to give my mother something for rent while I couldn't work. It also left me with thousands in medical bills I couldn't pay. I tried to talk to the hospitals and doctor's offices, but by this time the bills had gone to collections and I was told it was too late for them to be written off. I hadn't asked before because I thought they would be paid through the workers' comp. I don't have that much extra money ever. In a good year, I make the poverty line. And the other part of this is that I can't go back for treatment because I owe money, even though my injury continues to flare up sometimes. I have looked for another doctor, but it is very hard. I've had several recommendations, but two weren't on my insurance plan, and the third wanted $250 upfront for any workers' comp case. I managed to keep the injury from getting so bad I can't work by doing the exercises I learned in physical therapy, but it is still very painful sometimes. I can't leave my job because I'm lucky to have it. All this has made things I used to take for granted very difficult. I can't drive much, as that hurts almost as much as working. I've had to give up my beloved art, maybe forever. I must save my hands for work. The schedule I work is also hard for me. In order to be granted enough hours, I've had to open my availability to work to any time the store is open, which means that on any given day, I could be scheduled at any time between 5:30 a.m. and 10:30 p.m., and I don't know beyond a week in advance what the schedule will be. I can't promise to go to anything that meets regularly during those times, which puts a big damper on any sort of social life. I have also had to give up my Sunday mornings, which I specifically requested when I was hired, so I usually cannot come to church. It's really isolating. I feel like I'm so far removed from a normal life that I have to explain myself to other people. It makes me feel very alone. I owe all this money, and I don't have it to give them, and it tears me up inside when I get the nasty collection calls. There's usually at least one call every day. My credit rating is really bad. I shop at thrift stores for almost all my clothes. I can't afford a car. I don't have the money for an apartment. Even with Starbucks insurance, I put off things like getting glasses or going to the dentist because the money isn't there. It's hard not being able to afford the things my friends take for granted. Everyone expects that an adult has a cell phone, a car, and since I don't, it's difficult. I'm told I should finish college, but between the schedule and the money, I have no idea how I could do it. I wanted to have my own family someday, but now I don't see that happening. I sometimes feel like there isn't a way out of this.
Thank you, Catherine. And now Wendy Bortz.
So I lost my job about two and a half years ago, and I decided that I was going to spend a little bit of time putting together a personal mission and vision statement to try to guide myself in the right direction. And I did that along with doing some training and computer work. And while I was doing that and looking for a new job, the economy started collapsing. So I found that it was very difficult to find a new job. But I guess I lost my job almost 3 years ago. About 2.5 years ago, I did accept a job offer on a long-term temporary basis, working with entrepreneurship, which met the mission that I had developed, doing outreach for people around the state, teaching them how to start their own businesses. And part of the reason it met my mission was because I wanted to start my own business, and I thought this would be a great way to learn how. So I've had a very wonderful time for the last 2.5 years. I'm currently doing an outreach program that would reach all across the state of Ohio to train dislocated workers on how to start your own business. And through doing that outreach, I've seen a lot of success stories. So I have some information in the CICT catalog if anyone is interested in entrepreneurship. Coincidentally, after we had planned this whole service, I got laid off. I heard 3 weeks ago that I was going to be laid off effective next Friday. So I am actually looking for a new job now myself. It's possible that I will be hired back, but there is no guarantees. And I just wanted to say that the day I heard I was being laid off, I had sent in the paperwork to get my business set up. My business isn't ready to support me yet, but I hope that in a couple of years it will be. And I do know that older people do have a much harder time finding jobs. So I'm excited about my business. The first thing I did when I found out that I had gotten laid off was send out resumes to a number of people and contact my support group here at the church. I've been in a women's support group for 14 years. It really means a lot to me, and I was actually going out of town, but just being able to share that information and know that I had supportive people here made me feel much lighter and much more capable to move forward.
Thank you, Wendy. And now, Ruby Linen.
After listening to some other people's stories, it really hit me how fortunate I am. I was unemployed for about 11 months, but for the past 5 months now, I've had a really, really great job that I love. And I like to think that I remember to be grateful for that, but this morning, especially after listening to what you said, Catherine, I realize how fortunate I am. But that's not what I prepared to talk to you guys about. During that time that I was unemployed, Michael Greenman would often come up to me and say, you know what, you should talk to so-and-so or talk to this other person. And particularly, he kept suggesting that I talk to Michael Dobson about networking strategies. And whenever Michael Greenman would mention this to me, I would smile and say, thank you. Oh, yes, that is a good idea. With absolutely no intention of following through. But finally, one day after the service, and this was probably about 7 or 8 months into my unemployment, Michael Greenman came up to me and quite sternly said that Michael Dobson is offering his expertise and I could benefit from it. And I was really surprised sort of by the insistence in his voice, and I sort of, you know, said, okay, fine, I'll go do it. And it was good, and I did learn some things from being in that job search group. But really, since then, I've reflected on why it took me so long to take advantage of that resource. And what I've realized is that it was my own arrogance. And that's not pretty, and I don't really like saying that to you, but every time I turned down those offers of assistance, it was because I was thinking things like, well, I probably wouldn't learn anything new, or, well, other people need that, but not me. And there's a lot of problems with that kind of arrogance. One is that it puts up walls between me and other people. In pushing away Michael's help, I was pushing him away. I was foreclosing the possibility of any kind of relationship. And I think that's a pretty crappy way to behave and a pretty awful way to live. So one of the things that I've learned from this experience is that I need humility in order to accept help. And not really so much because of the tangible benefits of whatever services are being rendered, but because it's only with that kind of humility that I can create and deepen the sort of relationships that you need in order to build community.
Thank you, Ruby. Now, Fujio Hayashi. Hayashi, sorry.
My name is Fujio Hayashi. I was laid off in December of 2008 and did not find full-time employment until May of this year. It took almost a year and a half to find full-time employment, even though people say that I'm well-qualified. I have both bachelor's degrees and master's degrees in mechanical engineering from MIT and also have an MBA. I have worked as a senior executive for several Fortune 500 companies. When I became unemployed, I could not get individual health insurance due to pre-existing conditions, as some of the people have mentioned. I had to get COBRA insurance, which was only available for 18 months. I was lucky to find employment when I did, as COBRA would have ended in June. I was fortunate that we had enough money set aside so we did not face immediate financial difficulties, but it was still tough since my youngest son will be attending Carnegie Mellon University this fall. Carnegie Mellon has an annual tuition alone of over $40,000. My two older sons also attended Carnegie Mellon, and I did not want to deny Brian just because of my unemployment status. Through persistent and extensive networking, I recently found a job. I would like to recommend networking, as Ruby has mentioned, as one of the best strategies for job search. Among the networking group that I found to be most useful was an alumni club. I am president of the MIT Club of Central Ohio. Through the MIT Club, I'm affiliated with Ivy Plus, a network that enables me to attend alumni club events of other colleges such as Harvard and Cornell. Another group that I found to be useful is Ohio Tech Angels. It's a group that invests in startup companies. I can strongly recommend two local organizations that help improve my networking skills, 40 Plus and Toyota Ridge Job Networking. The members are mostly unemployed, but they're very supportive and can help improve networking skills and offer other jobs search skills, tips and skills. I've also found my Covenant group here at First UU to be helpful in providing emotional and spiritual support during this time of turmoil. What can you do if you have friends who are unemployed? Offer to help them network. Meet with them over coffee and find out what position or area they're looking for. You don't have to know of an opening. Simply refer your friend to a well-connected individual in an organization or an industry that interests them. I am convinced that networking is the best way to find jobs. If a job is posted online or in the newspaper, there are potentially hundreds of people applying for this job. If a job can be found through networking, there's a good chance that there'll be no competition. If each of us can help our fellow unemployed by facilitating even one network connection, it will provide dozens of opportunities to make a positive impact in this devastating economy.
Thank you, Fujio. Our final speaker then is Lisa Strohmeyer.
As I listen to what my First UU family is saying, I knew I was a blessed person. I had no idea how blessed I am. The problem I'm going to talk about is very real to me, and I'm aware of the fact that it's all relative. Some of you may be in very dire straits thinking, yes, I know exactly what these people are thinking. Some of you may be saying, gosh, the problem I'm struggling with is very small. I shouldn't worry. But it's all relative. My problem is that I've repeatedly been told that I'm uninsurable. No one will insure me because I took steps recommended by my primary care physician to get healthy, get off the 12 medications I was on, make sure I didn't have diabetes, the need to have knee replacement surgery, or to have high blood pressure. By getting healthy, I saved thousands of dollars for the insurance industry and have guaranteed a happier, healthier life for myself. In December of 2002, I had gastric bypass surgery. I lost 170 pounds, and I'm now at a fairly healthy weight. I exercise regularly, and I don't emotionally overeat. In fact, I've developed a weight loss program that's used nationally. I have many doctors who refer clients to me so that their patients can become healthy. I've made a lifetime commitment for healthy living for myself and in helping others obtain healthier lives. I am not ill or on any medication, and for that I am very grateful. My long-term health outlook is quite good. But because over half of the people that have bariatric surgery gain their weight back, it is assumed that I will too, and therefore it is feared that I would become a financial liability to the profit-driven health insurance industry. This is my pre-existing condition. Due to this pre-existing condition, I have applied for and been denied health insurance by numerous insurance companies. I've worked with several brokers who are shocked each time I'm denied coverage. Even though they work tirelessly and without compensation to find some obscure company who might insure me. I am not looking for a free handout. I just want the right that is afforded to many Americans
the right to purchase health insurance at a reasonable cost. Currently, there is catastrophic insurance that I can purchase. Of course, it would not cover any pre-existing conditions. However, the monthly premium of that is twice of my monthly house payment. This is not an option for me because most of my income is dependent on what the insurance industry will pay me. In 15 years, I have not had a raise. And we all know that the cost of living has continued to soar annually. I am a part owner in a private practice which is thriving. I worry that I will either have to sell my practice and go work for a large company in order to get health insurance that offers group coverage. I live daily with the fear that if I become ill or am in an accident, I might lose my house and the retirement that I've been saving for. I'm lucky I have a house and I have money in retirement. At 50, it's not an option for me to go without health insurance. However, I don't want to go work for someone else. That's even wondering if I could get a job in this economy from what I'm hearing. I want to continue to be self-employed and provide a valuable service to my community by helping people get healthier, which, ironically, in the long run, lowers the health care costs for insurance companies.
Thank you very much, Lisa. And thanks to all of you for your candor and bravery in sharing your intimate experience and your situation with us. I know this was not easy for you to say or for the rest of you to hear, but this is reality.